TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Norman Finkelstein, Beyond Chutzpah. Beyond Chutzpah is the most comprehensive and well-documented work of its kind. Rational and unemotional, it is one of the harshest texts about the daily practices of Israel's occupation and colonization of the Palestinian territories. And it is an excellent demonstration of how and why the blind defenders of Israel, by basing their arguments on false facts and figures, actually bring more damage than gains to their cause. This comment was written by an Israeli, Baruch Kimmerling, professor of sociology at Jerusalem's Hebrew University. You can find the quote on the back of Norman Finkelstein's most recent book, right next to Praise by Noam Chomsky and Amy Goodman. While many Israeli and European writers welcome the book and agree with Finkelstein's findings on the Israeli settler movement, Gaza, the West Bank, and Israel's history of human rights violations, there has been only silence in the U.S. For decades, the U.S. government and Congress have been Israel's staunchest and, on many occasions, only supporters. This support comes both as defense of Israel's policies towards the Palestinians, as well as in material aid. Israel receives on average one-third of the annual foreign aid given by U.S. taxpayers. Here's part one of his speech, in which Professor Finkelstein turns his attention to the enormous wall that is being built on Palestinian land. He also comments on the recent removal of the settler colonies in Gaza.
Let's take the case first of the July 2004 ruling of the International Court of Justice on the wall Israel is building in the occupied West Bank. The ruling in July 2004, it didn't only discuss the legality of the wall Israel is building, but it also discussed or rendered judgments on a wide range of relevant issues. For example, the World Court stated in unequivocal terms that the territory Israel acquired in the June 1967 war, that territory Israel had no title to. That is to say, under international law, it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. And they repeat this several times, pointing out that that basic principle is found in Article 2 of the United Nations Charter. So by this ruling, the World Court effectively stated, Israel doesn't have title to one jot, one square inch of the West Bank or Gaza. Or I should also say, they stated as well, that these are not disputed territories. These are occupied territories. Number two, the World Court stated unequivocally that all the settlements Israel has built in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, all those settlements are illegal under international law, basing themselves on Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. That means all the settlers in the occupied territories have to leave, and all the settlements have to be dismantled. Number three, the World Court stated in unequivocal terms that East Jerusalem is part of the occupied territories. Therefore, Israel's claim that Jerusalem is the eternal capital of Israel, that claim is illegal under international law. At the end, the World Court ruled and this is the part most people are familiar with, that the wall Israel is building is illegal under international humanitarian and human rights law, that Israel has to dismantle the wall, pay compensation for the damage suffered by Palestinians, and the international community has an obligation to stop Israel from building the wall. Those were its findings. What's most illuminating is not so much the findings, but the consensus. There are 15 judges on the International Court. 14 of the 15 judges supported all the propositions I just stated. There was almost consensus with one partial exception. The partial exception was, unsurprisingly, the American representative on the court, Thomas Bergenthal. But even Bergenthal, he didn't actually call his statement a dissent. He called it a declaration. And in his declaration, he was very careful to state that on many points, he agrees with the World Court. For example, he states unequivocally that there is no question the settlements are illegal under international law. And if Israel is building the wall to protect the settlements, then the wall is clearly illegal. Now that's pretty striking, because you have a near consensus, 14 of the 15 judges on all the points I just listed, and a full consensus on some of the major points I just listed. Nonetheless, in American public life, none of those points is at all accepted. In fact, on most of the points, it's unmentionable. I mean that in a literal sense. You are no longer allowed in any of the media to refer to the West Bank and Gaza, formerly Gaza, as occupied territory. The technical term now is they are disputed territories. You're not allowed to refer to East Jerusalem as occupied. Typically, if you see a byline in a newspaper, it'll just say Jerusalem, not comma, occupied West Bank, just Jerusalem. And you're certainly not allowed to say that the settlers and settlements are illegal settlements in occupied territory. So topics which in mainstream public life are beyond controversial, they are unmentionable. When you come to the World Court, there's a consensus all the way at the other end from what you read and witness in public life in America. Let's turn to a case even closer to the present, namely the Israeli so-called disengagement from Gaza. There was a huge amount of media coverage of the disengagement, probably not since the World Trade Center disaster had there been so much coverage of a single event, at least to judge from the New York papers. And I think it's fair to say that the picture that the media was drawing of that event was that amidst all the torment and anguish of this withdrawal of the Israeli settlers from Gaza, that Israel had now produced a monumental gesture ending the occupation of Gaza, and that now the ball was in the court of the Palestinians, that they had to reciprocate with a gesture of equal magnitude to the one that Israel had just produced. That's what the media said. But then when you turn to the human rights organizations and other authoritative bodies, you read something altogether different. So let's start with the main Israeli human rights organization, dealing with issues in occupied territories, B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. In March 2005, B'Tselem issued a hefty report on Gaza, entitled, appropriately enough, I think, One Big Prison. I won't go through all the details of the report. Let's just turn to the conclusion. In the report, it states at the end, reviewing the disengagement plan, the final version of it, it says, well, according to the disengagement plan, the economic arrangements which Israel has instituted with Gaza, those will remain in place after disengagement. Two, Israel preserves the right to militarily enter Gaza at its will, according to the disengagement plan. Three, Israel will control movement of all goods and persons and labor between Gaza and the outside world. Four, Israel will preserve control over the land borders, the airspace, and the water surrounding Gaza. After listing all of these caveats to the disengagement plan, B'Tselem concludes that, quote, it's questionable whether the occupation has actually ended. If you then turn on August 19th, Human Rights Watch, the main American human rights organization, though it has a global mandate, Human Rights Watch issued a statement on the Gaza withdrawal. And the statement stated, let me just get the exact words, it stated, whether the Israeli army is inside Gaza or redeployed around its periphery and restricting entrance and exit, it remains in control. There's no end to the occupation. In fact, the principle is perfectly transparent and obvious to any rational observer. If a jailer throws the keys of the cells to the prisoners, and the prisoners free themselves from the cells, but then the jailers redeploy around the prison and shut tight the gates, the prisoners are still in jail. Now, it's true they can move freely now inside the jail, but it remains exactly as B'Tselem put it. It remains one big prison. That's at the legal level. How about the practical level, the level of daily life? How will that change? Well, the world's leading authority on Gaza is a researcher at Harvard named Sarah Roy. She's written the definitive study of Gaza. And after the so-called disengagement, Sarah Roy wrote an article. She said, well, Gaza will remain, I'm quoting her, an imprisoned enclave. And that if anything, the most likely scenario in the foreseeable future is that economically, things will drastically deteriorate in Gaza. That's not only the opinion of Sarah Roy, it's also the opinion of the World Bank, which in its study of the Gaza withdrawal similarly stated that if Israel seals Gaza's borders, the disengagement plan will, quote, create more hardship than is seen today. That's the magnanimous gesture in reality in Gaza. If we turn to the West Bank, the picture is actually much worse. Israel proceeds with the construction of the wall. As far as it looks now, the wall will absorb about 10% of the West Bank, including the most fertile soil and the crucial water aquifers. The wall at this point in Jerusalem, there's again a very good mainstream report, the International Crisis Group put out a report entitled The Jerusalem Powder Keg. And in the report, they make the following points. Number one, the wall as it passes through Jerusalem is going to wall inside Israel 200,000 Arab Jerusalemites who are going to be cut off from the West Bank. It's also going to cut off about 100,000 Arab Jerusalemites outside the wall who will no longer have access to their schools, medical care, and jobs inside Jerusalem. Furthermore, the report states that the wall as it's presently being built will, and now I'm quoting the report, come close to dividing the West Bank into two. And finally, it states that if the wall incorporates, as it now seems, if it incorporates Jerusalem, it preempts any possibility of a two-state settlement, because it's inconceivable for there to be a Palestinian state without Jerusalem as its capital. Or as they put it in one of their metaphors, a Palestinian state without Jerusalem as its capital is like a chassis without an engine. It simply can't be. And the conclusion they write, it's worth quoting in the midst of all of the talk about Israel's magnanimous gestures which need to be reciprocated by the Palestinians, the International Crisis Group, I have to emphasize, very mainstream, it's one of George Soros's spin-off groups, they write at the end, for all Prime Minister Sharon's talk about supporting a two-state settlement, they conclude that these claims of Prime Minister Sharon are at war with any viable two-state solution and will not bolster Israel's security. In fact, they will undermine it, weakening Palestinian pragmatists and sowing the seeds of growing radicalization. Well, that will be the sort of the topic we're going to now explore in the burden of tonight's talk. How do you explain this spectacular discrepancy between what eminently mainstream human rights organizations, authoritative bodies, legal authorities like the World Court, between what you read in their documents, their verdicts, their statements, on the one hand, and the conversation in American public life about the Israel-Palestine conflict? Or to put the matter slightly differently, how does one explain the fact that when you look at the mainstream documentation, the mainstream record, there really is next to no controversy? Everyone seems to agree on everything. And yet, when you come to the mainstream discourse on the topic, it seems that there's a huge amount of passionate disagreement and controversy, so much so that people throw their hands in the air in despair and say, "Who are we to believe?" As if there are so many different sides and so many conflicting attitudes. But, as I've presented in brief and will document in a moment further, there really isn't a welter of conflicting attitudes. In fact, one has to search very hard, and I mean this literally, I'll illustrate in a moment, one has to search very hard to find any disagreement on the actual record on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Before I do that, I want to begin, if I may, on a personal note. I first became involved in the Israel-Palestine conflict. I can date it exactly. It was June 1982, at the time of Israel's invasion of Lebanon. After June 1982, I joined together with other Jews who opposed the invasion. We formed a little group with the horrible acronym JAMAL. As a member of the group, lots of topics came up for debate and discussion. And one of those topics was the question of Zionism, as in, are you now or ever have been a Zionist? And so for the next couple of years, I sat down and began to read, quite voraciously, I think, on the Israel-Palestine conflict, in particular on the question of Zionism. And at some point, I realized that this is as interesting a topic as any, and I turned it into the topic for my doctoral dissertation. Come April 1984, I had completed the research phase of my doctoral dissertation and was about to embark on the writing stage, which for those of you who have done it, and I suspect there are several in this room, you know that's one of those dreaded stages, and you keep saying, I should check one more book, as you try to find an excuse to put off the writing part. And as it happened, that one more book did come along. I remember it quite well. I entered the Harper and Row bookstore, and on one of the main shelves, there was featured this very hefty volume entitled From Time Immemorial, The Origins of the Arab-Jewish Conflict Over Palestine. And truth be told, I began to tremble. Because, as everyone knows, a book comes along and seems to be saying, all the research that you have just done for the last 2 years is worthless. I was very worried by that prospect. And the thesis of the book, if true, would have revolutionized our understanding of the conflict. Because Peters's book, her central thesis was that Palestine had been empty on the eve of Zionist colonization. The Zionist settlers came, made the desert bloom, and then Arabs from neighboring countries surreptitiously sneaked into Palestine to take advantage of the new economic opportunities created by the Jews, and then pretended that they were indigenous to the land. And so the central thesis was that individually and collectively, the 4.5 million at that time Palestinians had fabricated their genealogies. I went at Joan Peters like Captain Ahab went at Moby Dick. I sat down with that book. It had, as she liked to boast, 1,853 footnotes. And I sat down in the research library, the New York Public Library Research Library, and went through those footnotes one by one by one. The core of the book was a demographic study which purported to demonstrate, through analysis of population movements, that the Palestinians weren't indigenous to the part of Palestine that became Israel. That particular study had a certification at the end by a fellow named Philip Hauser, who was the director of population studies at the University of Chicago. So now I was taking on the director of population studies at the University of Chicago, who said the study was accurate. I wasn't going to be intimidated, though of course I was scared by the conclusion. And I sat down for several days in my little apartment. It was a Raskolnikov-type apartment, this little studio in Washington Heights, with my pad and pencil, and I'm going through the numbers, going through the numbers, going through the numbers. I've got to figure this out. And one night, it was around 1:30 a.m., suddenly my eyes started to water. A chill went down my spine. I discovered the key number in the study was a fake. It wasn't a mistake. It was clear by the way the material was arranged. It was the fake. I couldn't believe it. You know, I got up from my bed and started to pace the floor of my studio apartment going, I did it! I did it! I did it! As Paul Sweezy said to me a few months later, he said, yes, Norman, discovering a fraud is every scholar's eureka. And it was my eureka moment. Well, after that, I became publicly involved in the Israel-Palestine conflict, and now it's been roughly two decades. And one of the questions that I couldn't help but ask myself, naturally, is, what did you learn from the past 20 years? And strangely, I came to the underwhelming conclusion that the main thing I learned from the Israel-Palestine conflict is it's not very complicated at all.
This was the first half of a one-hour talk by Professor Norman Finkelstein, Assistant Professor of Political Science at DePaul University. He spoke about his most recent book, Beyond Chutzpah. Come back for the second part of his talk when TUC Radio returns. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order an audio tape or CD of this talk. You can find more information on Norman Finkelstein on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information how to get a copy of the one-hour talk by Norman Finkelstein by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD or tape order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gallardon. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.